Well, welcome everybody. Lovely to see you all here. And my pleasure, the second time in 24 hours, it's a real privilege to welcome Professor Susanna Baer. Susanna, as you all know, is Professor of Public Law and Gender Studies at the Humboldt University in Berlin. She also holds a distinguished visiting chair at the University of Michigan. But most spectacularly of all, she is a justice on the German Federal Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe. And Susanna has very kindly agreed to have this conversation with me. We're going to try and keep it very informal. The way we're doing it, it is being recorded. Susanna has very kindly given her permission for that. When we get to, I will ask a series of questions and we'll have a sort of conversation back and forth, but then we will make time for you to ask questions at the end. And although that bit will be recorded, we will give, Susanna will go through it, and she'd like to be able to talk more openly than necessarily she would be able to if it was all going to go on an LSE podcast. So just to tell you about that. So, Susanna, let's start at the beginning, as it were. Do you think there's anything in your background? You tell us a little bit about your background, and do you think there was anything in your background that would have predicted this very special career trajectory which you've had?
Prediction, no. The famous phone call, and it was indeed a phone call, came as a total surprise to me. The phone call meaning a politician from German Parliament calling me up and saying, you know, I would like to meet you. And I thought, okay, you'd like to meet me in Germany, a public law professor, meeting with some eminent member of parliament is not such a rare occasion because we're born experts in parliament and in constitutional proceedings, so the status of public law professors is extremely high and close to state power, so that is not the total surprise. And it was the Green Party, so always the other side, and that other will play a role, I think. Yeah. So I was not totally surprised. I would have been surprised if it would have been the governing party, because that would not be my claim to whatever. And so that came as a surprise. There was nothing predictive. However, by now I see there may be two or three things which are very important in who I am now and why they picked me. And one is certainly what usually goes as identity, which I think is a bit more complex than that, whatever, but that I was known as a radical feminist, two terms which carry a lot of different meanings for different people, but nonetheless radical feminist, meaning active in some struggles around domestic violence and pornography, et cetera, et cetera. So what the politicians later told me, someone who would stand up for her cause, for particular causes in society against the mainstream, risking her career. I would not have said that about myself. That would be quite a vain statement, I think. But it was interesting for me to hear that this was a selection criteria, that I did things thinking about whether I should do them and maybe I would never, ever be a professor in my life, which was my dream job position, and did them, partly because I thought they're not going to hire me anyway, so, you know, why not do it then? So an outsider perspective, positioning myself in many career steps, which then qualified me for those who picked me to call, which I thought was interesting. So my being a radical feminist, being a woman in a predominantly male profession, being a lesbian woman who was not flagging the issue around all the time, that would have been weird because the issue as an issue did not exist in German academy, and the identity as an identity did certainly not exist. Quite to the opposite, I got warnings when I started as an assistant in the university that I should not be out. And so I developed the strategy of not lying, but also not flagging, but not lying. And so my life was known, and my partner was visible at times. And that was another factor which certainly was very important for them to, again, pick me, call me. For them, they thought, you know, there's a perspective on life, but also there's an identity we like, and, you know, we want to do something for minorities, and we want to be seen as doing something for minorities. And so I did fit their picture. But it also did a lot to my perspective on the position I have and on what I do, not taking it for granted ever. So I still sit there, not that I pinch myself every morning, but every second morning. And I do a lot of things, and I see a lot of things, and I meet a lot of wonderful, great people in top positions now, because I'm one of them. And I'm amazed at times, but I also, I don't take it for granted. I do not just move there. There is this little, interesting, you're here, what do you do now? There's this question to myself. So that identity part is definitely important. There are other things, like I was born in Saarbrücken near the border to France. And Saarbrücken, the Saarland, went back and forth, France and Germany, historically several times. And if you live there, it's a very, very, very small state in Germany, you develop a kind of European identity. My parents were, right after the war, joining the Young Europeans, which was a civil society organization, very early on, which I didn't know when I was a child, but certainly there was something in my household and upbringing which was naturally European. And that became an obvious, I realized way later on the court now how natural that comes to me, as natural as the outsider perspective. My outsider thing, not that I don't belong, but that I don't take it for granted, the first thing. And the second one is, we're in Europe, it's Europe, what about Europe? And so that really did a lot. And I realized very late that this shaped my take on national, post-national, transnational issues tremendously. And there may be a third one, which is for brothers and sisters. And it may be, a petty fact, but I think I enhanced that experience of a social being in the world, and never only one being in the world, but always dealing with others in an interpersonal relationship with several others by practicing a particular type of sports for a long time, which was rowing. And when you're a rower, you're completely dependent upon your co-rowers in a boat. When they lift a finger, you feel it. So if you want to have a social experience, that's a sport to engage in. And I did that for a long time, and I was a team player. I wrote the eighth in the end, and there are eight people in my Senate. So I think that prepared me very well. In fact, when I had my preliminary hearings right before the vote was taken on whether they would elect me to the court and the parliament, and the Conservative Party meeting happened, which was, whatever, an interesting meeting in itself, in that building, the German eighth, the boat, hangs from the ceiling. And I left that room with the guy in charge of the conservative politics, and we were both skeptical whether they would ever vote for me. And we looked up on the ceiling, and I said, oh, that's the German eighth. I know what that feels like. And I felt really comfortable in that boat. And he said, okay, I remember that. I'm going to tell them. You're going to feel comfortable. Okay, well. But so I think being used to a team players, which then, besides rowing, which is a very biographical sketch, in my academic life, being part of gender studies and not primarily part of law school also was a social experience of sorts. Well, in Germany, when you're a law professor, you're supposed to be on your own. You're the thinker on your desk. You're a little Goethe person. You write your books, and you're the genius, basically. But in gender studies, you're, for many reasons, interacting with people. That's why we call it transdisciplinary, not only interdisciplinary. You're more than interacting, you're sharing. And so my academic life was built on an experience, and not just a theory, but on an experience of not only being dependent on other people, but also profiting and enjoying other people. So this always being not just me in this world as an intellectual person is certainly something which does a lot to my being at the court, but it also, again, was a factor. The politicians, at least those who suggested, proposed me to be elected, took seriously. They thought we need someone who's willing to talk to, in my case, very conservative people, brethren on the bench for 12 years and be nice to them and convince them that I'm right and be a socially bearable person. And when you're in such positions and you're defined as the left side of things, as a polarizing, coming from a polarizing position, that to them is luckily very, very important that you're not the forever dissenter, because a dissenter doesn't shape jurisprudence. I mean, it's interesting for academics to read dissents, but really the case is then not decided that way. So for them to find someone with the outsider identity, but then also with the kind of natural social, I want to interact with people, I'm used to interact with people, I'm used to interact with difficult people, and I keep doing it even when things get a little, when water gets a little rough, that to them was very important. That's at least what I was told. And I think some factors in my life shaped that to a degree.
Great. Well, I want to come back to some of those issues about the many sort of insider-outsider hierarchies that shape anybody's experience of being in an elite institution such as a constitutional court, and also ask you a little bit to say a bit more about something else you've touched on, which is the sort of political nominations to the court, which is for English lawyers is a very amazing and revolutionary sort of concept. But before we get there, can we just go back a little bit to your choice? I mean, I'm assuming that you're someone who excelled in your academic work at school, so you could have studied many different things. What drew you to, you studied political science and law, didn't you?
Yeah.
What drew you to them? Were you already quite sort of political? Did you see law in a political way?
Yeah. Yeah, I think talking school up to age 18, basically, I think I grew up in a political household. It was taken for granted to discuss politics. What else would you interestingly discuss? Well, we didn't discuss whatever, opera. There was theater, but political theater. There was a collection of the young German Die Spektakulum, which every household of that kind and type and class has in their homes, whatever. So, but politics was natural. My father was a professor and a law and political science guy, and was deeply shaped by the. He was born in 1930, so had an experience of the last days of the war. Came from a rather military family, and lived that promise of never again, in controversial ways for us as protesting children, because he advised the NATO and the German military on political education. And we were in fights with him for the longest time, but politics were there. And if one would want to see it that way, law was there as a factor in politics. All right, not as something unknown, and not, but not the lawyerly law. The law as a political factor was somehow there. So yeah, politics always something, and as a child in school, we were already staging some protests, and so you were the speaker of the class and whatever, and we staged a theater play to protest was, being critical was kind of the call of the day, but most people were. I was no exception. To the rule, and then being totally identified as a sports person, that was my other life, kind of. And when I had to decide where to study or what to study, it was clear that I needed to study in Berlin because my training was based in Berlin. So, and then, I wanted to do something political. There was a clear sense of, you know, not leave power in the wrong hands. That was always the, you know, not leave anything to the wrong people. I wanted to understand it, but also to do something about, which now sounds very pathetic maybe, but there was a sense of injustice in this world. There was always a very strong, I remember myself as a child singing to myself justice songs, self-made justice songs. This side, like, you know, I think we cut this from the interview. But it's true. So there seems to have been a sense of justice, which may have to do with things like I grew up in a very poor area in Saarbrücken because it was a coal mining area which went down the drain with the restructuring of industry. And I saw poverty and I saw class. At the time, I didn't see race because there was no, or ethnicity, because there was no big influx of foreign workers, but I definitely saw class. And I saw the injustice of class, of poverty. That was a very, I have vivid memories of many such instances. So there was a sense in there. And there was something about sex discrimination where I thought, you know, why do you treat me differently? I have a brother 1 year older who we were kind of siblings, and I remember being angry at so many instances in life where he was treated differently because he was a boy, and I'm like, what? You know, that kind of what I never noticed as anything special. It's just how you walk in the world, and you open your eyes, and you see it, and then you're angry. That's how it is. So politics was natural, and that kind of sense of injustice was natural, and so what do you study? I was not good in mathematics. I wanted to become an architect. I was not courageous enough. It was not around. And so, yeah, politics. And then law and law school. And law school in West Berlin, Free University of Berlin. It's a wonderful university, yes, but I thought it was a rather problematic course of studies because there were all these elitist sons and daughters of lawyers, and they all felt like they belong already, and they all looked as if they'd already made it, and I was totally insecure, felt like, oh my God, I don't belong, I'll never get it. I was afraid to enter the huge lecture halls. So I saw 10 people out of 400 who were wearing black leather jackets and looked a little lefty to me. So we formed a critical legal student court watch group, actually, and went at the time to visit court proceedings against lefty protesters, because it was a time in Berlin when there were the squatting movement and the rest of the peace movement and the very, very last moments of the lefty terrorist, the RAF challenge to everything out there. So I ran away from mainstream legal studies to form that group and to be there, and then I ran a little bit further to political science, which was in fact next door and is an interdisciplinary institute, the Otto Suhr Institute, which was founded after the war as an interdisciplinary institute, economics, law, history, and sociology, and was known as very, very lefty and had student projects and had feminist studies, gender studies, women's studies at the time. And suddenly there was a world of not only students, who didn't intimidate me, but also people, professors who were talking about the world. And so I studied that. And then I decided, you know, when exam time came, I thought I'm not able to do both. So which exam do I take? And I decided for the vernünftige Weg, the rational way, and took the law exam. Why? Because the law exam is the more powerful exam. Mm. And if you want, you can observe power, but you can also find one of the tools of power, and I wanted a tool, so I go for law. Then I took my law exam, which was not a brilliant exam. I mean, after that course of study, that's kind of why should it? So it was not a brilliant exam. And then I went on with my second part of the legal education in Germany, Referendariat, the internship stages, where you visit courts, et cetera, which I found terrifically interesting. Went a little bit to the United States, saw a civil rights organization, which shaped my view of using law in practice, the Boston Women's, now the National Organization of Women in Boston, which ran a legal something, was very important, and came back, took my second exam, wanted to write my dissertation, registered myself as unemployed because I had no money. I don't come from an affluent family, so there was, the economics were not great. And the job office called me, the state called me and said, there's a job offer and you have to apply. I'm like, you know, I wanted to live on super mini unemployment. I didn't even want money. I only wanted to be formally unemployed. So they sent me off to this German government thing, environmental planning, government section of environmental planning, and I sit there and signaled that I don't want this job and certainly got the job. And so next day I started for a year and then I left. I started for a year as a part-time legal advisor in the city government at the time when they were planning the Potsdamer Platz and with a conservative head of the section. And he took me to the...
So this was just after...
Just after law school, the second
this
state
was exam. Around unification.
Yeah.
Around
yeah.
that time.
Yeah. yeah. And so actually in my referendariat stage, unification happened and I had to draft overnight on an old typewriter the regulation which opened the banks to hand to the people from the East 100 DM as welcoming money. I my sense of lawmaking is based on that experience. It was very interesting. Go write it. And I wrote it and the banks were open. It was really it was really interesting. So whatever. But then I had my 1 year real administrative down to earth regular job, yet also in a ministry, a state ministry. So lucky or interested or curious enough, open-minded enough maybe, so that the conservative guy in charge took me with him to all the pre-parliamentary sessions with his buddies in the Conservative Party. And I said to him, you know, why do you do this? You know that I'm not in your camp. And he said, well, but I better hear the question before I get it in Parliament. So you're going to ask me the question. I said, okay. And I learned a lot. It was really, really very interesting. Also to deal with, you know, the representatives of Sony who were building their buildings on the Potsdamer Platz. Sony? So huge, huge corporate law, big time people. Me sitting there as tiny Miss Junior legal somebody from the government, but the government and law in my hands. It was very interesting to see how power works in those settings. And still dreaming of becoming a professor. In Germany at the time, almost no women, less than 10% in all faculties, certainly not in public law. I did not really see the opportunity. But I wanted to try. So I was dreaming and pursuing it a bit and trying to write my doctorate. And when I handed in a proposal for my doctorate and an application for a scholarship on the equality clause in the Constitution, the professor said, this is not only a boring topic, but also he thinks I'm not talented enough to ever write a dissertation and certainly not ever get a scholarship, and he would not take it. That stuck with me a long time.
I remember talking to you about that because that's around the time that I had the good fortune to meet you. And what you're saying about women in the German Legal Academy speaks to me very powerfully because my own experience, as you know, was that I arrived in Berlin. I was then a fellow of an Oxford college, and I was spending regular time in Berlin because my husband was working at the Wissenschaftszentrum. And I did what I would have done in America or Canada or Australia or anywhere else, which was I wrote to colleagues who worked in my field and introduced myself and tried to form a network. And I can still remember the sounds of the doors banging in my face. And looking back on it, it's sort of obvious to me now that people just didn't think I could possibly be who I said I was because I was 30. And I said I was a tenured Oxford professor, you know, in their money. And I remember, so we talked a lot at that time about, and now at that time, just to take a step aside for a moment, you were planning to go and study in Michigan.
Right.
Remember right. Was that an attempt to kind of reinforce your, recruit your strength to try again with this equality dissertation, or what?
No, I had traveled to the U.S. because part of my two of my brothers and sisters had moved to the United States, and I visited them, and it was, you know, one of those road movie things.
Yeah.
I rode a wreck across country to think about what I'm going to do, and for some reasons, I ended up at the Women at the Law conference, and I met somebody. I met a friend, and she introduced me to Catherine MacKinnon, who I had no idea who that was. And so I hung out with her and went home with literally that much paper, which were the hearings on the ordinance against pornography passed in Minnesota. And I went home and read it all, and thought and looked at the pornography market in Germany and thought, you know, this is outrageous. What's happening here? And this is violence against women, and, you know, why is nobody doing anything about it? And this was a little bit earlier, even during the time of my second state exam. So I was studying for the second state exam, and at the same time I wrote the law. I wrote an ordinance. I wrote a draft law, a German draft law, which was the first time that there was a civil law, a civil rights law against violence, that for German lawyers, criminal law, civil law, public law, clear distinction. To have a civil law against violence, that's crossing a line which should not be crossed. So it was a first, and I drafted that, and for many reasons, it was debated in national parliament, whatever. So there, it started the pornography debate there. And with that, I had another exposure to an intellectual field, feminist legal studies in the United States. I had seen something. I had a glimpse of that there are feminist legal studies out there, and I did something politically with it. But I wanted to, then after that thing with the German government, I said, you know, I'm going to have a last attempt. I'm going to try one more time to go for what I intellectually sought, what I was looking for, an intellectually critical experience. And simply applied. I thought I'm not, you know, it's, and I was totally arrogant. I applied only to 4 schools, top schools, and I got into 2, which was very, very good after that experience of being rejected with basically you're too stupid. So it was to get the Harvard letter in particular was for me quite a good moment, I should say, to get the Michigan letter as well. And then I thought about it and I decided to go to Michigan because I knew I wanted to work with Catherine MacKinnon, but also I wanted to be at a down-to-earth university where they're not, again, already there when they're admitted, but where they are somebody when they finish. So, and that's just the Michigan style to me, that it was very important that they're hardworking, it's a state university, they're top, but they admit a more diverse group of people. It's not as elitist. And so I went there. And then that it was a last attempt, really, to go for my intellectual whatever. I ran in huge debt. I did not have a scholarship in the beginning, nothing. It was totally crazy. I had no backup from my parents or anybody else. And then I started working in Michigan as a student, something, and worked my way off my debt. So, and Michigan was then nice enough to give me a third of my tuition as a scholarship, which I will have to repay in case I ever go into private practice, which I really like. It's a kind of threat in my life. In case I want to make big money, I'm going to pay it back. So I got support there and recognition. And I remember after a few weeks, I sat in the library in the middle of the night and said, how great, nobody thinks I'm crazy that I'm doing this, to sit in the library in the middle of the night and read radical legal theory. I loved it. And so that year showed me that there is a space somewhere, which is maybe a university, where I can do what I think I want to do, with certainly Catherine MacKinnon being an active litigator and policy advisor and not just in the university, that mix. And then I returned, and the window of opportunity was Humboldt University, recreated after unification as a space with not the male positivist, whatever, mainstream tradition, which was there in other German universities, but they wanted, the faculty there wanted to create something new. They wanted to be more open-minded than everybody else. And that was my moment. So I thought, okay. And started teaching a small curriculum and then dragged internationally renowned people to that position, which was you with 2 others, and had you signal to the world of German academy that they're brilliant people out there and they're going to miss out on them if they don't create something like a space for critical legal studies, feminist legal studies. And then we created gender studies, and then they created the position which I now have. That's my chair.
Yeah.
So you paved part of the way. You know that.
That's very generous, but I'm going to call you on that a little bit because you just made it. It's very interesting what you said about the Humboldt being more open because it was a restructuring university. As I remember it, talking to you at the time and also my own visit, so I think it was I was the second person, wasn't I? Fran Olsen was the first, and then Renato Seletzel. Who else did you have in that program?
That's all.
Yeah.
I
remember that nonetheless, the Humboldt was still structured on the old Lehrstuhl system, which was the traditional public law, criminal law. And you had an enormous institutional job on your hands to carve out space with the support of one or two of those senior public lawyers, the space for this program. But to embed that institutionally took a tremendous amount of... And you have since actually had various very senior roles in sort of university governance. I don't want to spend too long on that. But, I mean, that must have been quite a formative experience, that enormous. You were at a very early stage in your career in what is an extremely hierarchical system, the German academic system, where, until you're that full professor, when you're basically God, it is a real, real struggle. And everything is calibrated very formally. But you had the courage to say, this really needs to happen. We need to make this space.
This courage... There are people around me. I never did anything on my own. There was always a context of a group of people who wanted similar things. So it was always way more than me. And there's necessity. I don't remember it as a choice. It's either you can be there, and so you better shape the place, or you leave. It was also clear to me that, and there were discussions with some Lehrstuhlinhaber, real professors, about it, who advised me otherwise, who advised me to drop the famous quote, if you keep working on women, foreigners, and others, you might not ever have a career. In Germany, that sounds even better. But I remember that vividly, and it's a well-known, very liberal, famous professor who told me, who I'm not going to name now. So I got lots of advice to, concentrate on writing, concentrate on mainstream, write your habilitation or your dissertation at the time on a, more mainstream, don't be so feminist, whatever. And it was in some way not an option, partly because there were so many other people I saw who were fighting for different spaces or at least space there, who I wanted to join and who I would have felt like leaving, partly because I came there as an outsider. I was still in many ways still a homosexual, on some counts always an outsider to this. So the offer was also never to fully join. There was always something in my life which would never fit and totally not fit. So yes, courage. By now, looking back at this, I sometimes wonder when I wrote anything, because all this institutional engagement you need to put up, all the time, all the efforts, all these, strategic meetings, that takes a lot of time. But I was not alone. It was my space. It's you keep fighting where you are. It just so there was no alternative, really. And again, which may sound kind of unbelievable, coquette almost in German, I did not think I would make it. I was in a postdoc stage there. I was in a doctoral stage and then in a postdoc stage at Humboldt University. And I thought, nice, you have this in between now, and they're creating this funky space because they think it's great if they can tell the world how tolerant they are. But really, they're never going to make you a professor. Like, you're never going to have a chair in your life. You're never going to be tenured anywhere. So, and I had a while doing that and fighting for gender studies and everything, I drafted a business plan. And I still have it. I was serious about this. I drafted a business plan for an equality institute, an out-of-university research and advisory institute, and I have it. It's a file. Because I needed to plan an existence outside of that setting, because I had seen quite a few older women, particularly feminists, who really had shattered lives because they were dependent upon a career they never got. And I had promised myself early on, I saw somebody commit suicide because of that they were Azorians and never made it in that system. And I promised myself, I'm never going to be fully dependent on this. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to be at their hands, at their grace somehow. And I needed a real, and not just some stupid fantasy, but a real plan that whenever I'm in a hiring situation, I'm not going to commit suicide when they don't give me the job. That's not going to happen. And that was very important to me, to have another. I had another life, my queer life, as people would call it now, my whole, you know, scene and friends, and they were all not in the university. There was nobody a lawyer. This was all another life. My political friends thought I'm leaving them becoming a lawyer, because that was conservative. So there was that political, queer, whatever. And then there was the university, but I could not be dependent upon the university. That I would not give that to them, that power of definition. So that created a space where I was maybe sometimes a mixture between courageous, stupid, and naive, but also bold and not ever alone. That was very important. And lucky on one count, and that's really lucky, because I got a postdoc position with somebody who was basically not interested in advising or exploiting the juniors. In the German system, you're the professor and there are two dependents and some students also dependent on you, and that's your little kingdom. And usually you have to follow your master, really. But you're also somewhat sometimes exploited by them. And my master was not a master. And he was basically, you know, we discussed what I should do, and I did it, and that was it. And I could do, the rest was on my own. So there was a lot of freedom in that situation, and so I created that. And in addition to that, then the financing for that position came from gender studies, and people, again, in the law school warned me that if I would take that money, I would be labeled as the gender cheapo person, the not really belonging person, and I took the money nonetheless. Because again, I thought, you know, in the end, you're not going to hire me anyway, so why not take the money now? So, and I started creating research stuff early on, earlier than others, at least in the German system, always in this mix of, you know, you don't want me anyway, so I do what I can do now. With a deep commitment to it's really necessary to do that, with also either the United States or foreign or other countries or other actors recognizing the value of my work. There was also always a dimension, either politicians or NGOs or Americans or whoever, who told me, or visitors, who told me, what you're doing is not totally stupid. What you're doing is sort of interesting and actually needed in this world. So I always also had a little room of resonance which appreciated what I did. I don't think you can do that with no one ever saying, great. You need somebody saying, great, keep doing it, because otherwise you go crazy or you drop out or you're lost. So there was always a little, somewhere there was somebody thinking it's a good idea, but not in the mainstream and not in the things which really count and
So let's come to the court now. You've already talked about getting the call,
the phone call.
Literally the call. Yeah. Yes. Could you just say a little bit? This will be really of interest to the English trained lawyers about how the system of party nomination works and how you see that as shaping the nature of the court as an institution.
Mm. Yeah. The The law says that the German parliament or the German second chamber, the Bundesrat, elect judges or justices to the court. And there's a minimum number of career judges, means from the judicial career regular track, 3 in each Senate out of 16 total. And the rest of the judges, for historical reasons and many others, are predominantly professors or politicians. There have been 2 lawyers to date on the court, and there's a debate that we should get a lawyer on the court, but the top lawyers are not interested because the pay is too low. It's simply financially such a loss for them that they wouldn't come. Whatever, for some other reasons. But so predominant, so it's politicians, parties officially, proposing candidates for parliament or the Bundesrat to elect them. In parliament, I'm a parliament person, half as Bundesrat, half as parliament. I'm a parliament person. In parliament, it's the judicial committee where all parties in parliament have members in, proportionally. And the judicial committee, at the time when that seat, the committee needs a two-third majority, a large majority. The tradition is unanimous votes. Either you get all votes or you don't get in. So what they do is they have proposals from right and left, and they pre-negotiate whether the candidate is acceptable. And they run the candidate's name through the most important, the key players, which is also the Bavarian government and the chancellor and whoever is out there interested in the politics of law. And they run their names by them. And if the other party at the other end of the spectrum really vetoes them, then they're out. So they create a system where, yes, you have a right-wing or conservative or a liberal or a lefty person, but not extremely conservative or extremely lefty. Those extremes are voted out, are vetoed. But they make sure that you have the spectrum, because you accept theirs, they accept yours. It's a deal. It's, you know, we Green Party will accept your very conservative guy next time, but you have to take our candidate this time if they're not unbearable. So, and unbearable is an interesting one, because it's socially unbearable and legally or politically unbearable, but it's both, at least for the longest time. That, many people would say, created a specific quality in the composition of the Senates, because you have known political diversity, and you really do have political diversity. In the earlier days, there was also a regional diversity. They made sure people from the south and people from the north, and there was at a time a somewhat religious diversity in Protestants and Catholics. Protestant and Catholics. That's it. So as diverse as you can get. But that was important at a time that is not as important anymore. And I'm the second Green judge. So when the Green Party went to gained votes in the federal parliament, they started negotiating with the Social Democrats, with the left side, whether they get one seat from the left side. And they got, so they had the first Bride, who was there before me, and I'm the second. And the distribution of seats on the court follows slowly victory in parliamentary election. There's no rigid formula. It's more a consensus among parties. So right now we have a discussion whether a second seat will be offered for the Green Party, and we will have a discussion whether the left party will ever get a seat on the court, and we certainly will have a discussion on other smaller parties. There is right now somebody from the Free Democrats. Mm-hmm. Well, the Free Democrats were thrown out of federal parliament in the last election, so maybe that's never going to happen again. We don't know, because these are longer time negotiations along the political spectrum. Judicial committee. Judicial committee is still the defining committee, but now they changed the law and they're going to have a vote taken in full parliament on the proposal of the judicial committee. If that would have been the case when I was selected, I'm not sure whether I would have made it. because what in fact happens, you get the phone call, you are asked whether you're willing, then you get a written CV, printed out CV to Parliament, never in an email, because that will be leaked the next second. So it has to be on paper. You have to bring it there. And then they show this to the key players, and then maybe they accept you as a potential candidate. And then somebody, your enemies, leak it to the press. And that's a very interesting moment. You wake up one morning and you read the paper and you're suddenly an object of political controversy. And in the past, there were several candidates who were then kicked out because of public pressure in that phase, and they never got up to the vote. And I was afraid that would happen to me. So when the Green politician asked me, I said, first I didn't believe the question, so she said, I want to talk to you about the Federal Constitutional Court, and I said, oh, great idea, why? And she said, well, there's a position opening, and I said, oh, wonderful, I know three wonderful female professors who would fill that position, and I named three wonderful professors. And she laughed her head off and said, that can't be true. I mean, no men would ever do that. we were calling, by the way, you. And I'm like, what? I did not believe, and seriously, not just out of a legal, I did not believe that could happen. I mean, inconceivable, whatever. So the press phase is pretty nerve-wracking.
Mm.
And your enemies, whoever that is, people who would not like to see you on the court leak information to the politicians. So, and just in case you ever plan on such a move, people find out, I can tell you. I know who leaked counter-information to the politicians. Quotes from weird, weird radical law review articles published in Nowhere Land suddenly appeared in the hearing, and I was confronted with them, like published in 1980 Nowhere Land, and I'm like, and the quote was basically, the protection of the family in the Constitution is a patriarchal heteronormative reinstallation of privileges, da da da. I'm like, okay. So, and then I made it a point to find out who gave that sentence to them. Well, I did, whatever. So this is the phase where they start doing this. So because, it's a very, very powerful position. You're positioned there for 12 years. And basically, I would have to murder somebody to kick me out. So you are there, and you stay there, and you can do whatever you want, basically. And so they want to make sure it's not an easy decision. So there's this debate, and there's this, you're suddenly the object of public fantasies and quarrels and fights. And they did that to a degree. And then there are these informal, day before the vote is taken, hearings with the parties. So you visit every party in the administrative buildings of Parliament. And you talk to them, or they talk to you. It's very different, very, very different. There's no rule, there's no media, there's no public. It's an uncontrolled, interesting space. And then the next morning, the official vote is taken, and you get a phone call again, whether it went through or not. And then you're there. Very often, these are very short time frames. You get the first call, 2 weeks later, the real call, and then 1 week later, you start. With me, for various historical and political reasons, I was asked very early, the beginning of the summer, and the vote was taken in September, I think, and I started in February. Very, very long time, very unusual. There are reasons for this. I think one biographically maybe for me interesting moment was that in between them asking me and the vote, was the what we call the public lawyers meeting, the Staatsrechtslehrertagung, which is the meeting of all these kings and few queens who are professors of constitutional law in the German-speaking world. And they were certainly gossiping and debating who's going to be the predecessor of Pride, of the other green judge. And I was hanging out there and standing there. And they were certainly debating that, maybe they want a woman. Yeah, the Green Party, they may want a woman. And then they went through the names, and I was standing there. And my name didn't come up. And I thought,
that was really irritating to me. But you can then imagine what fantasy I can develop on reactions to me then being elected. Very diverse reactions, to put it that way. There are people, and we have anecdotes from cab drivers who overheard a conversation of my colleagues that I'm elected to the court, which were not ever to be printed, let's put it that way. Outrageous, hurtful, resentful, envious, the whole thing, but also really shocking to me. There were also some who were like utterly surprised and loved it. There was also in particular a moment in many, many mainstream camps that they were so proud to have somebody like me, my favorite, somebody like me in such a position. And when I'm in a very, very good mood, I ask them what exactly they mean by somebody like me. How freakish can you be to have somebody like you? Like, what is it? What do I signal for them? What do I stand for? But there was this moment of pride among people that they're so super tolerant to have such a queer being in that, in these echelons of position. Very, very interesting and very real. That's also not a theory. This is experience. Yeah.
Well, you've given a really sort of wonderful and deep, painful sense of you know, the complexity of the way all those different vectors of assumption, power, interpretation fed into the process of your selection. How about to the actual process of your being in the court? I mean, here are all these, you know, established status hierarchies. There's gender, there's sexuality, there's age, maybe. Not so, you know, yours is a fairly young court, very young court by our standards. But still, you're relatively young when you were elected. Your professional background, you're an academic, you're a very particular kind of academic, and you're Green Party, so you're not one of the bigger party. So how does that, this sort of both psychological and intellectual kind of positioning, how does it shape your daily life as a judge? Say what you feel you can say.
Yeah, difficult.
That, yeah.
A little bit difficult, because there's certainly a secrecy of proceedings in the court.
Yeah,
and
I don't mean specifics, but just sort of do they...
Just to clarify, I'm not a member of the Green Party.
It didn't matter to them.
Yeah. It doesn't matter in my court. There are many judges who are members of parties, particularly the Conservative Party, and it's known, but it doesn't matter in the court anymore, because it matters who proposed you. But since you get this broad vote, you're accepted. And then it's a small institution, so it's smart enough to then hug you and fully embrace you and invite you to be one of us, one of them at the time, to become part of the institution, and make sure that the institution is stronger than you. There's a whole culture, and there are tons of rituals which are welcoming rituals and which make you part of an institution as a collegial unit in the world, and make the institution more important than you are. We are not in the common law. We are not there for life. We are only there for 12 years. We inherit the gown. We wear the gown of our predecessor and the predecessor of the predecessor, et cetera, et cetera. We go to the office where we don't select much which is in there. We take the office of the guy who was there before, and we hand it over to the next. There are many, many, many little things, material, cultural things, which make you part of the institution right away, and not the heroic, I made it, I'm on top person. Not as much. At the same time, since you're defined as specific in terms of your political leanings and your biographical background, you're also called upon to bring that view to court. So there is an built-in diversity of viewpoint and professional background, at least, and somewhat biographical experience, small town, big town, conservative family, children not married, these things are somehow taken for granted. They're there, they shape you, yes, they're there. But the most important, I think, is that there's no call to be a hero. There's no call to become a pop star as a judge. That changes. The personalization of politics also is also personalization of courts these days, and the media in particular is very keen on divide et impere, on divide and conquer, on taking us apart and taking us as individuals and having the portrait and reporting on judgments as saying, you know, this is a Susanne Bär judgment. And Susanne Bär is this and that and da 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 da. But it's rare still in Germany, because also there's no assignment of cases by the Chief Justice on political counts. It's all defined by law. I brought the procedural rules. It's a very legal unit. So being at the court transcends many of the issues which were out there before. There's also a sense of, now you're there, it's the top position. I mean, you cannot get anywhere else from the mind of a constitutional lawyer in Germany, that's it. I mean, that's Wolke Sieben. That's, you know, you're beyond, there's no further development in what you can want in your life, simply. And the institution gives that to you, that, you know, now you can calm down, you know, stop, you know, struggling, because now you have an Amt in that position. Yeah. That is what is there.
What about the move from being the kind of legal scholar that you were, which is a critical legal theorist, feminist theorist, law and society person? You know, I'm much in the same mold myself. We basically approach law as a phenomenally interesting social practice set of doctrines, but essentially we're studying it. We have a sort of external perspective on it, as well as having been trained to, you know, manipulate legal doctrine as more of an insider perspective. Once you're in the court, you're an actor, you're an insider, you're part of what's developing that doctrinal inner life of law. Is that a tough position to make, and do you still feel that you can bring, you talked a little bit about this last night in your lecture, can you still bring your law and society perspective to your role as a judge?
Yeah, I mean, what I was describing earlier is very much the welcoming attitude of the institution as such, to kind of embrace you and make you part of it. The other side is me arriving there. And there, the being trained in critical legal studies and law and sociology and having kind of an ethnographic take on the practices of law makes a big difference, at least from what I hear talking to my colleagues. That is a difference I bring to the court. The attitudes of all of us differ to a degree, depending on where you're from and what you expected in life. But certainly, I watch us in some ways, and I tend to take things in and to note things, like the courtroom design or the rituals or the tons of informal rules that govern such an institution in some way more than others, not because I'm smarter or anything, but just because I'm trained to have that perspective and perception. And that makes life as a justice of such a court really different. Because the morning I walk to the court when we have hearings, or particularly the big hearings with lots of media attention, et cetera, I watch my own being there and the court differently. Because I sometimes talk to colleagues about this, and they're like, what? I didn't see that even. I did not see things they saw, so it cuts both ways. But it certainly does something. There is in my experience, an advantage in there, in that I have a very trained political science trained, critical legal studies trained sense of the institutional value or the institutional design and the institutional, the being of the institution in this world, an institutional take on things. There's a very clear sense. It's always something very important to my understanding what we do. So if we discuss a press release, that will shape your perspective on the value of a press release, on the message you want to bring across, et cetera, et cetera. If you discuss how you stage, whether you should participate in a state function and what you should do there, what you can do there, which court to invite, which court to visit, how to visit, what to give visitors. All these institutional design questions come very kind of natural to me. And that does something to this being. So it's kind of clear that I take over some certain functions in the court, as I did in the university.
Yeah.
Kind of we end up doing certain things. And being a comparative constitutional lawyer, I now run the translation and international development little subcommittee in my court. So there are things which you kind of bring and carry on doing. There is also, however, a risk in having this observant mode, being trained in this observant mode, observer's perspective on a court as an activity, an adjudication as an activity, in that there is a temptation to, again, run away, to distance yourself. As running away from law school to political science, I could run away from, in the conference room, deliberating the case and deciding the case to watching me decide the case. And that's a real difference. And I'm somehow also trained in doing that. And I try to be aware of that risk of changing my position and perspective in what I'm doing and trying to deal with this, trying to see both as an advantage but not fail my real mandate and obligation to decide and be fully there and not just be an observer of people deciding. It's I'm the one to decide. And so that is part of the experience. Being there in Germany, one should say that the transition from a public law professor or constitutional law professor to constitutional law justice is not as wild. You lose academic freedom. You lose freedom of speech, but you win the defining voice. So that's a good trade-off, I think. But to the transition from a gender studies interdisciplinary critical legal scholar to a justice, an applying person, that's another transition, a very particular transition. One would maybe be able to see in the end in the files they collect about what every justice does during their tenure at the court, that I will tend to explain the court to the public, while others tend to explain judgments. And I tend to also always explain or try to explain the court as an institution in a particular setting. So from my outside appearances, you will be able to see a trajectory there, I would think.
Interesting. So I want to open it up in a minute, but just finally, and before giving you a chance to pick out any themes you'd like to underline, diversity on the bench, a matter of great debate in many, many countries. There are very few countries in which the bench is as diverse as egalitarians would like it to be, not just along lines of gender and sexuality, but also ethnicity, all sorts of... what are the most important features of judicial diversity? Why does... You've got a real opportunity when you've got a bench of eight that you really can have different voices coming to the table. Is that a really important component of adjudication from your point of view?
Yes, particularly in a setting which is bound towards consensus. And that's a difference, whether you build in diversity to constantly dissent and have divided benches and 5-4 decisions or whatever. I mean, the situation in very many common law courts, or whether you have an institution which says, you know, we want 8-0 decisions. I mean, almost all our decisions are 8-0 decisions. It's like we struggle intensely to avoid anyone not joining the decision, and dissent is the like ultima ratio. That's a lot. That takes a lot. So if you have the institutional culture and leaning towards consensus and predefined known open in the world diversity as a program, that's a good combination. And by this I mean, first, you know, because the political parties proposed the candidates, everybody knows, you know, she must be a lefty or whatever the Green Party is. It's an interesting mix. A civil rights person somehow, that type. And the others are conservatives, predefined conservatives, and the other one is the liberal, and what liberal in a continental sense, not in an American sense, et cetera, et cetera. So that makes things kind of out on the table, and then we start working. So this is not the issue to find out while they're arguing, but this is there, but that's not that interesting anymore. Then it's then interesting how this translates into your reasoning in a case. That's where it comes to. And so that political diversity, which we officially have, is already good, interesting. It also is legitimate then to bring arguments from a particular perspective without even having to label that perspective. Nobody would ever say, you know, from a conservative perspective, this would be such and such. But people would simply say it and one would know, yeah, that's their background. Also, professional background, professional diversity, which is built in by law, career judges and academics and others, is important, particularly politicians, that politicians are allowed on the court, but they have to be fully qualified lawyers, not like the French. That's important. Then, officially, there's no call for gender diversity, but politically there is. In my Senate, there are two women. It's very, very important that there is not one only. For a long time, there's only been one in that Senate. That's a different life. That's a different situation. So I started with another woman, and maybe at some point we're even going to be more. The critical minimum has to be more than one. That's for sure. That's very important. It's very important because it does not allow my colleagues to label my perspective as the woman's perspective. That's the most important part. So in interesting ways, the more diversity, the less diverse labeling you have, which is very good. Other diversities are not officially an issue. So sexual orientation is officially not an issue. The court made an effort to be super, super, super inviting, embracing, tolerant, et cetera, et cetera. Uta, my partner, got a huge bunch of flowers when I was introduced. The conservative press hated the moment. The president hugged me and hugged her as well. The press hated that moment, really. But the court made a point to say, you know, she's here, she belongs, we're with her. And my colleagues, my conservative colleagues as well, do make a point to that nobody ever doubts that I totally belong. So that's very nice. Mm. So, but that diversity, it's not a diversity issue officially to anyone. However, we have cases on sexual orientation discrimination, and there it was certainly there. And it was very interesting to see, and very challenging also for me, to see how does a court deal with cases where they in fact debate you. I mean, where it's in fact about you. And in fact, it's about their privilege compared to your disadvantage. And everybody knows. Because I'm living in a registered partnership, these were registered partnership discrimination cases, it was totally clear, we're talking about your and my tax account. Now. And that was a challenge, because in the German culture, it's officially a non-issue. So how do you discuss it? In South Africa, you would be able to discuss it in conference. And I talked to colleagues in other courts in South Africa in particular, because they're sent by civil society with their identities, and so they're called upon to bring that identity to the table. In Germany, in the German legal culture, to bring identity to the table? Nope. You don't do that. I mean, we're lawyers. So we're still living in the not positivist, stupid, but positivist world of, you know, law is the void of those features. So what happens is that some of the things I do and argue and bring to the cases or the table or the discussions are labeled as, in some interesting coded way, women or other or weird or emotional or whatever. That happens. That happens, certainly. However, there's no official code. There are those subtle codes. These are exclusionary codes. It happens. I'm shocked when it happens. I have to deal with it. I have to think about it, what I do. But diversity, so saying diversity matters on many counts. I could also give more examples. What matters in my experience is family background, big time, family life, personal life, what people take as normal. Normalcy assumptions are the big one shaping your perspective on everything you do there. And the normalcy assumption is very much coming from your family background, your upbringing, your educational kind of, yeah, what was normal for you, where you think you are simply because you are there. So and religion, to a degree, at least value order, religion type-ish things, and experiences like coming from Berlin, living a queer identity to degrees, having a political life as a young student, where it came naturally to me to go to rallies, demonstrations. Most of my colleagues have never been at one. Freedom of assembly, let's have a discussion if you've been at one or not. That is a big difference. So there are interesting diversity issues relating to experience, youth identity, student formation, things like that. People having lived in other countries or not. That's a difference on your comparative take on issues. So there are many, many things where it matters. The more socially relevant factors you bring out in the open and discuss them as productive features of coming to consensus again, productive features, components of the effort to come to a consensus, a convincing consensus, the better. So I'm proposing, I'm trying to make an argument that you should be more open about the diversity there. You should feature this as a resource for an institution that has to come to consensus, which is convincing for a huge variety of people and actors out there. So I consider it a resource which should be brought to light and comes in very, very many variations to the bench. But certainly gender, sexual orientation, age matters. Age, just one comment on this. I'm taken way younger than I am. And it's not because of my looks.
So we'll ask you your secret.
It's because still in many social situations, people simply do not believe that I do what I do. I have very interesting black suit, formal dress, state function situations where people ask me, "And why are you here? And they're only people in that top positions. And I say, okay, I'm at the court in Karlsruhe, which in Germany, court in Karlsruhe, I mean, there are various, but that's the one. And people say, oh, really, which instance? And it happens often. I told you that there were things where I was not, where I was held back by police, being the representative of the court next to Angela Merkel. And I was held back by police. And I thought, And so, and people, when I'm in a very good mood, I ask people, like, what is it? And they say, too young. I'm not the youngest at the court. There are several members who are younger than I am. But habitually, I'm young. The way I carry myself in the world is young. And woman plus that carrying myself, that's a bit much, as in tension with the image of the constitutional court justice. That's still an older, habitually older man. Even Andreas Voskuhle, the president of the court, challenges people because he comes off as younger. He is not younger than the other presidents of the court, but he carries himself in a way, a very accessible, friendly way, and that's already in tension with the image of a president of the court. But I'm seemingly far away from the dominant, the hegemonic thing people expect. So these things happen to me. Yeah, so diversity matters in very many ways. Yeah, I would say
that. We're only going to have about 5 minutes for questions, thanks, Jeremy. But I would like to at least get some in. I'm sorry that we haven't had more time, but what you've been saying has been so fascinating. I haven't liked to interrupt you. Would anybody like to? We'll collect up any questions that there are rather than having back and forth. Joe and Linda. And, yeah. 1, 2, 3.
Thank you. Well, we've heard a lot about your past, but I was just wondering when your term is up, would you like to go back to gender studies, or does politics hold any interest?
Interesting options you name. But very quickly, because it's a factual thing, the 12-year term in Germany, the legislator defined that I keep my chair at the Humboldt Law Faculty and Gender Studies Center, so I have the option to simply return to Humboldt University and, you know, take up where I left. That's a legal right. We do not have to quit our positions. It's very important. And I have my position be replaced by junior people to make a career, and let's see.
So Linda, and then Insurance. Yeah.
Hi, that was really fascinating. Thank you so much. And I wanted to ask you about, you were talking about being in the court and being both an insider and an outsider, and as a critical scholar, having been trained to see how hierarchy and power manifests itself, the materiality of the court and the rituals. So I imagine you did have a trained eye to sort of spot those things happening, and it must have been funny to be part of the ritual as well as spotting it. But I wonder if there's anything that surprised you about becoming a judge as a critical scholar, whether there's anything that you thought, oh, I wasn't quite expecting
this. It's my favorite question I ask my clerks after 1 month. What surprised you? What surprised me in my court, and what I keep telling people when I give them the tour of the court, is the effort put into an egalitarian materiality. So the chairs are the same height. The space at the table is exactly the same. It's circular. It has the same things on each side. There are tons of things which are so equal one would not believe it. And the hierarchical rule is ancienneté, so duration of service at the court, not age, and not some other weird thing next to president and vice president who have representative functions and particular administrative functions. But otherwise, everything we then do, like, you know, access to the car. We don't have, not every judge has a car and a driver, but we share. The regular judges share 2 cars and 2 drivers, and so you have to announce whether you need the car for whatever. And, you know, the longest serving judge has the first hand, and that diffuses so many power games in very interesting ways, because you fall back on that one, end of discussion. But I was fascinated in the beginning how many little things are done in that court, have been done in that court for the longest time, to create a materiality of equality among the justices, the judges, and very the pens we get, the furniture we can order, the books we have. I can give you little stories on all these little institutional details, resources, recognition, how you're greeted, how you greet somebody else, how you interact. That was totally fascinating to me, and still is. Still is.
Yeah. I think we probably better take the last two together, if that's okay. Sorry. You, Susanna? Yeah. Doesn't matter which order.
My question was, it's very, very closely to what Linda just asked, but I was just interested in how your experience in Karlsruhe is basically shaping your interest in politics, and whether the experience you've had as a constitutional judge has raised new political issues that, as an academic, working mainly on gender, is there any other politics in it that you haven't considered yet?
Do, do we take the second question now, or do
yeah,
I?
Okay. I think so, yeah.
My question relates to the public role of the judge. Now, there has been some debate whether judges should be more outgoing with their views and also, you know, talk more to the press, and President Hospital certainly has done that. Another great example would be Judge Thomas Fisher, a criminal judge, and who's making a regular, who has got a regular op-ed on a website. And my question is whether you think that should be done, and if so, how, and whether the advantages in gaining legitimacy operate.
The last question first. Courts are complicated institutions, and I think part of the mandate serving there is explaining what we do. And this is not only done through rulings. So I think there is a necessity and actually an obligation to go out to the public and talk about what we do and what we did, et cetera, et cetera. There are clear limits to that. I'm very fond of ethical restrictions or professional restrictions of that, so I'm not particularly fond of some judges who I think are actually disastrous to the state of the rule of law in the country, really, way beyond anything acceptable. And their criteria I would use. Collegiality is a criteria I would use. So you talk with restraint, big time restraint when you talk in public. Andres Voskuhle, the now president of the court, does way less than Hans-Jürgen Papier, the former president of the court, way less, by the way, but is seen as doing way more, which is interesting. There are other criteria. So quantity, format. I would not go on a talk show, and I think no judge ever should. The panels are difficult for me. A lecture with a Q&A is okay. Q&A is already pretty tricky. Not too much Q&A in Germany. Q&A, mostly not. You're not part of a political discussion, so if, you know, I'm constantly invited to things like, you know, the future of equality in go on a panel with so-and-so and their politicians on the panel, never. It's a format which I would never do. Future questions, difficult. There is a, you know, you talk on a meta level, on institutional design, you know, Europe vision, constitutionalism, but you do not ever touch on any political plan because everything will be in my court. So first, I'm not stupid. I don't want to excuse myself from a case. And second, I think it's an outrageous violation of my mandate to occupy a space which is not for me. I already have a very powerful space in defining what's going on in the world. I think that other space in the papers, in the blogs, et cetera, is for others, academics. Why should I profit from my position now and be everywhere? I could. I mean, I can, you know, the list of invitations, dream time. I mean, coming from the outsider, radical feminist, lesbian, I don't belong position, suddenly you get an offer to, you know, be in all defining public spaces you ever dreamed of. That's tempting, too. I think one should not go for that temptation. I really think that I have a very developed, strong opinion about restraint in that matter. And yet I do give talks in public. And yet I do think there's a necessity to explain, et cetera, et cetera. But there are very, very many limits. Quantity, quality, format, partner. We meet the government and we officially announce that we meet with members of cabinet every 2 years for an informal dinner. We meet members of parliament for an informal dinner. But we meet them there and we do not meet them for little chitty-chatty, you know, what's the politics next day? You know, can you tell me what to do with taxation tomorrow? Nope. That's not going to happen. So not even for my crowd. So if my favorite LGBTI la, la, NGO invites me for this and that, you know, no. I go to the charity dinner to give back my reputational kind of value to a community which was behind me or which I feel part of, but I would not give a speech there. So I make many, many such distinctions, and I think they're very, very important. Regarding your question, that's a great question. Thank you. I have to keep thinking about it, actually. The point is, I mean, as you know, in Germany, as a public law professor, you have to cover the whole thing. So my habilitation was about general administrative procedural law, and my dissertation was about freedom of speech and equality and dignity and da da da. So you from by way of training and portfolio, you already cover huge, lots of space. And I taught building and planning law, and I love building and planning law and environmental law. So I was an environmental law expert as well. So there are many political issues which were already sort of there. And beyond that, it's hard for me to answer that, because regarding topics, I'm simply so overwhelmed by the topics who are actually my cases that I cannot think of more. And regarding general, the political landscape, I have to say that being in that position, and being in 2016, and I alluded to that yesterday, I'm more worried than ever. I would not, if you would have asked me 10 years ago, you know, what's your take on the state of the world we're in, I would have been way more optimistic and way more positive. I'm really deeply worried. Also, maybe because now I'm meeting people who carry the responsibility to take all these decisions. And I see the complexity is such a word, but really the burden in some way, and the real problems to implement anything I care about. So the problem of politics is way more real to me. That may be an experience. So, yeah, maybe that one.
Susanna, thank you so much. Everybody probably knows that you're going to be here for the rest of the week. Susanna's in Neil Duxbury's room, 6:10. So please pop by to say... Sometimes, not all that. She's not chained. We haven't chained her to her desk. This has been really fascinating. I have a very vivid memory of coming along to your habilitation defence at the Humboldt many years ago and being deeply impressed. And I wish I'd known then what lay ahead for you, because I remember being so tremendously admiring of the way in which you created what you did create at the Humboldt. And I think it's just wonderful that you've been able to come and spend this time. One thing we haven't had time to talk about is the quite extraordinary caseload that the Constitutional Court bears. So it's very special that Susanna's been able to carve out these few days to spend with us. And thank you very, very much.
Thank you.